Could I have your attention, please? We're going to begin now with the introduction of the report by CSIS on critical infrastructure attacks. I am Stuart Baker. I'm a visiting fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and also a lawyer at Steptoe & Johnson and formerly an official at both the Department of Homeland Security and the National Security Agency. I led the team that produced this report. But to introduce it and the event, I'd like to ask Phyllis Schneck to come up. Phyllis is the Vice President and Director of Threat Intelligence for the Americas at McAfee, and well-known to many of the people here and to critical infrastructure threat analysts everywhere for her participation in a number of boards and reports on that topic over the last several years. Phyllis?
Good morning, and I want to say thank you very much to everyone for being here, to our audience, to our panelists, to CSIS for helping us create this report, for hosting us. The topic we introduced today, as we see, this is the first report of this nature to look globally, to look at critical infrastructure protection with the thread, the nexus of cybersecurity and the international connectivity running through and supporting and enabling all of critical infrastructure protection. Often when we've looked at CIP, cyber and international are separate tracks, and this is the first report that looks at the entire problem globally. A few things that stand out from this report in the size and the scope, the outstanding differences in the different countries. When CSIS looked and spoke and looked at the cultures and different positions of these different countries, the vast differences in how they look at the problem, how they look at infrastructure protection, how they address it, if they address it, the candor of the respondents, as you'll see when Stuart goes through some of the findings. The other interesting impact is the economic side of this. This event coincides with the World Economic Forum in Davos, where our CEO at McAfee is also speaking today, looking at how we address critical infrastructure protection with cybersecurity, with this international connectivity, and looking at some of the numbers, for example, $6 million a day to mitigate and clean up a cyber attack, and the amount of money that goes into looking at both the proactive prevention and how that's different from actually cleaning up what a cyber attack can create. So we have a lot of discussion in the past on market incentives versus regulation, how we can balance that. And the numbers in the report shed some good light on how some of those numbers and the economic factors can actually incentivize our markets to perhaps behave more proactively towards cybersecurity, which will then go toward greater critical infrastructure protection. Because we do look at cybersecurity and international connectivity as the global nexus of CIP. When we looked at who would create this report for us, we went to CSIS for a few reasons. Number one, the integrity and the comprehensive nature of the research. The ability to be independent and neutral, have contacts to go all over the world, talk to people, get them to respond candidly, even be able to provide anonymity, but really go around to Sean Waterman and Stuart Baker were able, and their colleagues were able to really work with people within the different cultures and have them respond in a way that gave us some meaningful results. And again, as you'll see when Stuart goes through the paper. I've been honored to be part of the CSIS Commission to advise the 44th President on cybersecurity, as have some of my colleagues in the audience, and as they can attest, it's a lot of work, and everything CSIS does is a comprehensive and thorough job, and it's a pleasure to introduce Stuart Baker to go over the findings of that report, which is a very sequential fit in the ways that CSIS has been promoting and contributing to cybersecurity worldwide. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Phyllis. It's really a pleasure to be here and to be able to go through these the report. I'm going to present the most interesting findings in a slide presentation that's also on the web. We have a number of people who are watching this or listening to it on the web, and Both they and the audience are going to be a critical part of this. I know about three-quarters of this audience, and many of them know at least as much as I do about cybersecurity. And so I'm hoping that you and the experts on the panel will turn this into a dialogue. But in order for it to be an informed dialogue, I thought I'd go through the most interesting of the findings from the report. These are the five topics that I'm going to cover: the threat, which is real, preparedness, which is spotty, an actual measure of relative security measure adoption that we pulled out of the report, the many and unusual roles that governments play in this field, and then a couple of interesting outliers that we've plucked out of the data that I think may spur some further discussion. So let me start with the threat. It was really quite remarkable when you gave people anonymity how seriously they took the threat and how many very serious attacks they reported. 60% reporting theft of service cyber attacks, 29% saying that they'd received multiple large-scale denial of service attacks each month, two-thirds of those attacks, so now we're talking about one respondent in five, said there was an actual operational impact from those attacks. That's a significant drag on the digital economy. Extortion, one respondent in five reported extortion, and in some countries like India, those numbers went to two people in five, 40%. That is, a remarkably high and aggressive use of denial of service attacks and other extortion efforts. And then, of course, all of the other attacks and vulnerabilities that we've gotten used to seeing are at staggeringly high numbers, 89% virus and malware attacks, 70% plus for almost every other attack you can imagine, phishing, farming, and the like. Even the what I think of as more sophisticated attacks like DNS poisoning or SQL injection, we had reports of more than half of the respondents said that they had suffered those kinds of attacks. So very high levels of attack. Here's a breakdown of the report on extortion by country, and you can see that while the average, which is on the far end, is one in five, in places like India and Saudi Arabia and the Middle East, it's well over a third, up to 40%. This is something that perhaps in the United States is not as salient because for U.S. companies and U.K. companies, it's down around 10%. It's a much less serious problem in those countries and therefore may get less attention from policymakers than it does in other countries where the attacks are much more common. When we asked people whether they thought the threat was worse or better, by about a 2-to-1 margin, they picked worse, 37 to 21. Even more remarkably to me, 40% of them expected a major incident within a year, and 80% of them, practically everybody, thought that there would be a major incident within 5 years. And we defined major incident. You can see down at the bottom. It's an outage of at least 24 hours, loss of life, failure of a company, major significant consequences from an attack. And they believe that in the next 5 years we will see that, many of them believe we'll see that within the next year. So what are companies doing to respond to this unprecedented level of attack? They're not completely unprepared, but I would describe the preparedness as quite spotty and in some cases quite lacking. If you ask people for a candid assessment of how well they think they're doing, their company is doing, 13% say we're not at all prepared, and another 28% say we're not very prepared. Those are pretty high numbers given the threat level. But the modal response, the median response, is that we're somewhat prepared. We have some capability, and a substantial number, maybe a quarter, believe that they are extremely well prepared. But they don't have much confidence, or at least there's an undercurrent of lack of confidence in their sector and the sectors they depend on for services. 30% of them said, we don't have confidence that our banks and our telecom providers will be able to provide the services that we rely on to carry out our business. Now, there's a lot of variation by country in this statistic, so that the number of people expressing doubt about their banks and their telco providers were at a low in China, where 10 to 20% thought that there was a risk that they would, their suppliers would not be there for them. In Germany and the U.S., they were also fairly low. But in Japan, sort of surprisingly, 50 or 60% believe that their providers were not well prepared to deal with an attack. If you ask companies, how well do you think your sector is doing in preparing for attack? You also get very wide disparities among countries, and the most striking number here is that in the Middle East, 95% said their sector was not very prepared for ghost net style attacks, which is the attacks that have been making news in the last 3 or 4 weeks, including very recently with respect to the oil and gas sector. That was true for 50% of Japanese respondents. They also lack confidence in the preparation of their sector. In contrast, in Germany and the U.S. and Spain, there was widespread confidence, and only 13 to 17% of the respondents thought that their sector lacked reasonable preparation. Some of this is probably due to recession-based cuts in resources. We asked people whether they had suffered cuts in their security resources. And actually, the great bulk of them had not suffered significant cuts, but about 25% had suffered a 15% or more cut in resources for security as a result of the recession. I'm guessing that that's a little lower than the cuts that other parts of companies took in response to that recession, which may reflect the fact that the problem continues to get worse. But it is nonetheless an objective loss of capability for a number of industries. I think oil and gas, interestingly, suffered some of the biggest cuts, and I'll cover that a little later in the report. One of the things that we were able to do with this report that I thought was particularly interesting and useful is that we didn't just ask people, how are you doing on security? Are you doing a good job? Sometimes people grade themselves in ways that are not completely reliable. Instead, we asked them very detailed questions about what security measures they actually had in place. Do you encrypt connections over the public internet to your company? Do you encrypt email? Do you encrypt portable media? Do you have a firewall between you and the public internet, between your corporate units, and on and on? I can show you the list of the security measures that we actually asked about. Includes all of those, plus network access control, intrusion prevention, and the like. We were able to say that basic key security measures are still not widely adopted, that fewer than 60% actually have patched or updated software on a regular schedule, so that there are still significant flaws and lapses in our security measures. If we were able to take the security measures, the roughly two dozen security measures, and add them up to say, well, so how many security measures have individual companies adopted? What we thought that we would be able to do with that security measure adoption rate is determine which countries had adopted the most security measures, had done the best job of securing networks of all of the countries that we scrutinized, and to use an objective measure of security adoption, not just ask people to grade themselves, but to actually count the security measures that they had adopted. We were able to rank countries based on the extent to which they had adopted sophisticated security measures. What is striking about this is that far and away the largest number of security measures were adopted inside China. Chinese security measure adoption was 10 points ahead of anybody else, well beyond any difference between any two other countries. The United States was second, but a distinctly lagging second. And this suggests that there really is a determined approach to the adoption of security measures inside China that we don't see in other countries. This is not a question of whether you're a developed or a developing country. The top two countries in terms of adopting security measures are China and, rather distantly, the United States and then the United Kingdom. If you look at the least security-conscious country, the two at the bottom of the security adoption rate are India and Spain. This is not a question of development. This is a question of national will and focus on security. Let me now turn to the role that governments have played that we turned up in the course of the report. We identified four principal roles that governments had played as regulators of industry, as partners of industry, as policemen of industry and attackers. And then, unusually for governments, those are all fairly common government roles, but as attackers, infiltrators, and adversaries. And we'll come back and talk about our experience in that regard. Let's start with government regulation of security. What we found striking was how many respondents reported that they were subject to government-required auditing for security purposes. Almost half of the respondents said that governments had audited them to make sure that they met security standards, a figure that reached close to 90% in China, that the Chinese government agencies had insisted on auditing companies for their cybersecurity at a level that was 80 to 90%, well beyond the security stance of other countries. We also looked at the question, I didn't prepare a slide on this, but we looked at the question of the extent to which people relied on government as a partner. And I think overall we received a lot of anonymous complaints about the lack of good information sharing among companies, that remains. It's always been a sore point for governments that the industry has not wanted to cooperate more fully. We see that still in the responses to this questionnaire, doubts about the extent to which cooperation with government will be fully rewarding for companies that are concerned about security. Also, we look hard at the role of government as a policeman and the extent to which the government can actually prevent attacks or deter them. Overall, the response of our respondents was that they don't have much faith in the ability of government to stop attacks. The percentage that believe that current law in their country is inadequate to deal with cyber attacks reaches close to 80% in countries like Russia, two-thirds in countries like Mexico, whereas in Germany and the United States, the expectation that current law will protect against cyber attacks is still pretty strong. More than half of the respondents believe that current law is adequate to protect against cyber attacks. Here's one of the most interesting of the statistics, that 60% of our respondents believed that their sector is already under attack from governments. This is consistent also with a look at the particular kinds of attacks that are common, both large-scale denial-of-service attacks and ghost-net-style attacks, the kinds of attacks we saw in the oil and gas sector in the last year or two, the last week or two, and that we saw with respect to Google about 3 weeks ago. All of those attacks, and we received reports from the respondents saying that half of them had suffered attacks of the Google or denial of service attack style. This suggests that we really have a major problem with government-based intrusions, or at least government-style intrusions into the critical infrastructure. And I've covered that. We also asked respondents who had expressed concern about government, what governments are you most concerned about? This produced some very interesting statistics, what we would have originally imagined. Overall statistics were that 36% of the respondents were most worried about the United States as an attacker, 33% were most worried about China as an attacker, and 12% were most worried about Russia, and no one else really placed. That may reflect the amount of coverage that U.S. preparation for cyber warfare has received, and we certainly see very different levels of interest in particular attackers, so that our Chinese respondents believed that they were under attack, or they were principally concerned about attacks from the United States, whereas in Japan there was a substantial preponderance of concern about attacks from China. But a number of countries that you would not necessarily have expected identified the U.S. as by far the most the country of greatest concern to respondents in that country. So Brazil, Spain, Mexico, and Russia all identified by 2-to-1 margins the United States as the country that they were most worried about. I'm not sure that's an entirely realistic view of the landscape, and I'm sort of, as a former government official, quite concerned. But it is an accurate reflection of the opinions that were provided to us in the report. Let me close with just a couple of points that I've extracted from the report that I thought were particularly interesting. One about countries who are outliers, and another about an industry that is an outlier from a security point of view. China is, in most respects, an unusual participant and has an unusual approach to security when you look at the country's security posture as a whole. Chinese respondents report uniquely close cooperation with government officials, high levels of regulation. You saw the 80% to 90% audit rate for security.
very substantial confidence that government can help them to better their security posture, compared at least to other countries. And as we saw, a much higher level of adoption of security measures, a greater security consciousness, and many more security measures adopted by Chinese respondents than by others. Conclusion that I would draw from that is that the Chinese government has made and the Chinese society has made a concerted commitment to improving the security of their critical infrastructure. That's the overall theme that I would take from this report about China. This doesn't mean that Chinese security measures are producing a substantially more secure infrastructure than otherwise would be the case. That's a little harder to pull out of the data. In many of the security measures that we use, China is in the middle, more or less, in terms of how much security it's actually been able to adopt and whether the security measures it's adopted are effective. But there's no doubt that there is a strong effort on the part of the Chinese government to provide security. And if you compare China as a developing country to countries like Brazil or India, there is a substantial difference between the level of attacks and the level of successful attacks between China's experience and the experience of some of the large developing countries such as India. So that's how China is an outlier, and I think it reflects a very interesting approach to security from the Chinese government. And the last point that I'd like to make before we ask for some comments from our panel is the oil and gas sector. As many of you know, the Christian Science Monitor just had a long story about alleged intrusions into a number of large oil companies in the oil and gas sector. Some very interesting statistics grew out of reviewing just the oil and gas sector. The oil and gas sector, as reported, has more attacks of a ghost net style than any other sector, and it's 70% are subject to the kinds of very sophisticated attacks that we saw in ghost net. It also has more denial of service attacks than any other sector at a 66% level. Two-thirds had experienced those attacks. More extortion attacks than any other sector. More theft of service attacks than any other sector. And the attackers, uniquely in this industry, are more likely to go after SCADA systems than to try to steal funds or financial information. This is the sector also announced that the loss of a day of downtime for the oil and gas sector is probably 25% above average. It's about $8.3 million reported cost in the oil and gas sector if the industry suffers an outage. Remarkably, despite all of those attacks, this was just about the highest sector in terms of cuts in security spending. Whether that's whether the attacks are a direct result of the recession, the lack of continued spending on security is hard to say. But there's clearly an outstanding amount of security attacks and security weaknesses in this sector, and something that will be a continuing concern for the sector, as we saw in the recent news stories. So what I'd like to do, this is just background on the authors, which I won't spend time on. What I'd really like to do is first ask our panelists for comments from their point of view on the report, what they think is most interesting or most likely to affect the work that they're doing in the report. And then we will ask for questions both from the audience and Tom Gann from McAfee will collect the online questions and read them out. So let me now introduce our panel, and I'll do it in the order in which we're going to be asking them to speak. Asha Matthew is senior counsel for the Senate Committee on Homeland Security for Senator Collins, the ranking Republican member from Maine. And she has oversight of their cybersecurity activities. Next, we'll ask Jenny Mena to comment. Jenny's the Director of Critical Infrastructure Cyber Protection and Awareness within the DHS Office of Cybersecurity, and she oversees a number of critical infrastructure cyber programs. Next to her is Sue Armstrong. Sue is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Infrastructure Protection at the Department of Homeland Security, and she's Director of the Infrastructure Security Compliance Division at the Office of Infrastructure Protection, and therefore directly affected by the performance of the critical infrastructure in securing its networks. Next to her is Adam Rice, who's the Global Security Officer and the Vice President of Managed Services for Tata Communications, which probably carries more internet communications, at least around the world, than anyone else. A remarkably large network that's administered by Tata. And then finally, Phyllis Schneck, whom you've already met. So let me, without further ado, ask Asha if she'd like to comment on the report.
I'll give you a quick summary, I think, of some of the activity on the Hill related to cybersecurity. There are sort of various proposals that are floating around. Some of those bills are specifically focused on the electric grid and perceived vulnerabilities in the electric grid. And those bills are mostly focused on giving FERC more direct power to regulate the electric grid. There are also ideas and drafts and bills on cyber crime and strengthening our criminal codes and our ability to conduct attribution and international cooperation. Those are very focused on cyber criminal activity as opposed to some of the concerns that we have on the Homeland Security Committee. Before I jump to what we're doing on our committee, I think all of you are aware of the Rockefeller Snow Bill, which is now in its sort of its third iteration of an attempt to kind of look across sectors. And in our committee, we also are thinking about sort of cross-sector, what do we need to do? And I think, the report highlights a lot of the concerns that we have and that people in industry have. But we are also very cognizant that 85% of the critical infrastructure is privately owned, and it's very... without working in partnership with the private sector, it will be very difficult for the federal government to achieve very much of anything. So we would focus on enhancing the work that DHS is already doing, strengthening its ability to work in partnership with the various 18 sectors that they already work with. We would emphasize the continued development of best practices, the reliance on best practices within industry, the recognition that that the industry moves quickly, and trying to get ahead of that through regulation can be very difficult. At the same time, there is a narrow subset of critical infrastructure that we are concerned about, where the disruption could be catastrophic. As one of the slides talked about, that many people believe that in the next 5 years something catastrophic could occur, that because of a cyber attack. So we're talking about a fairly narrow set of assets domestically. Things like dams or chemical plants are an obvious thing. And in that area, we would adopt these are staff level discussions, I should say, within the committee, and they reflect more, I would say, the minority side view than the majority that's not here. So for those sort of narrow pieces of infrastructure, we would adopt a more proactive approach where DHS is able to work with the owners and operators of those assets specifically on their vulnerabilities and the mitigation of those vulnerabilities in some kind of more regulatory framework, but still understanding that each sector has its unique operations, its unique vulnerabilities, and that DHS would need to pursue these kinds of activities in a partnership model.
Thanks, Asha. I would say that if there's a policy conclusion that comes out of this study, it's that chasing, you know, yesterday's story of a vulnerability in one particular sector might not be the most productive, because the vulnerabilities we found were across all sectors. And while there are differences among the sectors, there are differences of 10% or 15% from one to the other. There's no sector that's done this superbly, and there's no sector that is uniquely burdened with attacks. Everybody is at risk here, and just chasing the energy sector or the electrical power grid might not be the best way to address the problem. Jenny?
Thank you. And I think the report definitely helps to highlight the importance and the complexity of the issues, and also the variation that exists across sectors in terms of security levels and how the different business models in the sectors result in different approaches to security. And I think as a result at DHS, we need to recognize that we need to have a variety of approaches to work with a variety of companies, recognizing their different sizes, their different resources. Something that we're doing, and you mentioned the importance of information sharing, looking at ways to share that really meaningful information, not just information, but something that's actionable in terms of the vulnerabilities, the threats, and implementable mitigation strategies from government to industry, from industry to government, and then between the different players. We're working on a number of new pilots and efforts, and this is an area that I think we really need to focus on to improve everyone's security posture across all of the sectors. And I think it's also important that the report recognizes the unique risks that control systems present. It's a major focus of ours. It's our largest program within our CIKR cybersecurity efforts, something that we need to continue to work with our government and industry partners to build and address the significant risks. And so, again, these are things that we at DHS, as Asha said, we need to work with our partners. We do not own and operate the critical infrastructure, and so we need to continue to work with our industry partners, but also the other multiple government agencies that have important roles in this process. So I look forward to reading the full report in more detail and also in having a dialogue.
Yeah, I think Sean may have the statistics at his fingertips, but one of the questions we asked was, is your SCADA system hooked up to the public internet? And do you see some risks, and are you confident you've addressed them? And the answer is, yes, it is. Yes, we see the risks. No, we don't think we've fixed them. Kind of shockingly weak security on some of the SCADA systems that are hooked up to the internet really across the board. I don't know, Sean, do you remember the exact statistics?
I believe it was two-thirds said that their systems were connected, and 50% of them acknowledged that this created an unresolved security issue.
Okay, so you got plenty of work, Jenny. Sue?
Thank you, Stuart and Phyllis, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. As a DHS alum, I have to say you look very well rested. And I want to just say a couple things about the report, and I think unanimous across the board that we all agree that it underscores how dependent physical critical infrastructure and key resources are on cyber. You look at U.S. industry, SCADA control systems, industrial control systems, process control, transactions, both in the financial and public health world, water, when the power goes out, wastewater treatment plants have a tendency to release sewage into the environment. One of the things that we recognized in building the Chemical Facility Anti-Terrorism Standards Program, the DHS authority to regulate high-risk chemical facilities, is the dependence on cyber, both in terms of process control and particularly for sites that have a lot of bad stuff that are remotely monitored. You know, there's not human monitoring presence. It's cyber-dependent. So we built one of the risk-based performance standards in the CFATS program to specifically require addressing cybersecurity. I think the report also underscores the evolution of the concept of resilience going hand-in-hand with infrastructure protection. In the IT sector, many, many redundancies are built in as a matter of doing business and having redundant systems, having backups, having relays, having root arounds. And the report begs the question, is that enough? I think it also underscores the need for healthy debate on the government's role in this picture. There are a continuum of activities that the government could undertake, standards, best practices, regulation, audit, and it's dependent on the government to have a healthy engagement with industry to answer these questions. And the report underscores kind of what we need to continue to do. Security is obviously a shared responsibility, and I believe that we need to push the public-private partnership that we have going under the National Infrastructure Protection Plan. Jenny works very hard on the cross-sector cyber security working group. I think we need to energize those efforts. We need to continue to deliver things that help industry help itself, such as the roadmaps to secure control systems that we've done in several sectors. And we need to recognize that industry is the thing that is going to keep and push the U.S. government to be nimble and innovative. The U.S. government is not announcing a new killer app today. I can assure you, I've read the Washington Post. Industry is. So we need to continue to partner effectively to look at research and development needs, what are emerging technologies to secure things that are important to U.S. industry, and how can DHS step in and help with even things like funding in our Science and Technology Directorate. I think it's also important that we have a plan to organize around, and Jenny and her folks are working very hard on the National Cyber Incident Response Plan, and we need industry involvement to make that plan into a reality. I think we also need to take a look at, and this is self-directed, at what the government or what is required reporting under the NIP in terms of cybersecurity as we move into the next couple of national annual report cycles. And I think we all need to work on what I call regionalizing the NIP. We've set forth this partnership framework. It's at the national level. We have the government agencies involved. We have the sector coordinating council stood up. But now we need to get down into where we are looking at regional and local jurisdictional issues. So we have in the cyber world, we have the multi-state ISAC, the financial services ISAC, a number of different organizations where we can use an existing structure to more effectively share information, to push out vulnerabilities when they're discovered, and the procedures to mitigate those vulnerabilities. One of the other concepts that I think this report touches on and is a big question in our mind at the Office of Infrastructure Protection is, how do we prove what we're doing is effective? What are our outcome metrics? How are we verifying that when the government, through U.S. CERT or another way, pushes out information on, hey, here's a vulnerability and here's how to mitigate it, how do we know action is being taken? So I think verification is the next step in the dialogue between the government and industry. How do we know we are buying down risk collectively? And then finally, very obviously, the report highlights the international aspect of physical and cybersecurity. We live in a global economy. Things that happen overseas directly affect United States industry, businesses, and our communities. So we need to think about how we widen the international dialogue on these very important issues. And with that,
Thanks, Sue. You mentioned early on the sewage and water systems, and while I did tell Asha that you shouldn't chase the whoever seems to be having the worst problems today, it was striking. If you look through the report, the lowest level of security measure adoption was in the water and sewage area, which suggests that a certain amount of attention to those organizations, perhaps because they have it's less likely that people will steal things. They haven't been as worried about attacks, but the interruption of service there is staggeringly dangerous. Adam, you're up next, and you're the person on this panel who has to deal with this on the front line most as a infrastructure provider, so we'll be particularly interested in your perspective.
Yeah, I was thanks to the CSIS for letting me participate in the study and then be on the panel. I do look at the report and the presentation from the perspective of a global carrier and a Tier 1 Internet service provider. The results, troubling but not very surprising, expected. Security probably has continually marched on towards being worse than better, and given the kind of reactive approach to dealing with cybersecurity and threats, that trend will probably continue. A couple of things that I did notice from my perspective as an ISP and a service provider is that our customer base globally is becoming more security aware. A few years ago, we would answer an RFP, and the customer might come back tangentially and say, you know, what about your security? And now we're seeing upfront that when our customers buy bandwidth or hosting services or co-location from us, that security is an absolute requirement. I think this is driven primarily because they have more regulatory burden than they had before, but our customers are doing diligence. They don't expect us just to tell them. They want to show up. They want to see it, and it's customer-driven. If we did not implement security and security measures in some of our services, we wouldn't sell our services to our customers, and that's a positive trend, I think. The other thing that is probably a positive thing is that technology is also maturing greatly over the last 5 years, and these DDoS attacks and malicious traffic that are plaguing people, up in the core, we have the ability to see that stuff pretty clearly. We have the world's largest denial of service mitigation and monitoring service, and we sell it to our customers as a pay-for-service, but the monitoring part of it does allow us to see most of the traffic that transits our core. And we can see this traffic, where it's coming from, where it's going, where it's aggregating, and we can pull metrics and flow off of that. I think that's part of the solution, is being able to notice it, see where it's coming from, and then in the case of our paying customers, we kill it in the cloud, but as a larger, perhaps proactive security measure run by governments and such, there is that technology is maturing to the point where you can get this stuff at very high bandwidth rates, see it, and take care of it. Which makes me think that after reading the report is that with the current way of dealing with security, it's always reactive. Everyone's always shocked by the latest attack. They're always just amazed that it just keeps getting worse. But we're always reacting to a known threat. And it's the unknown threats or the emerging threat that everybody is taken by surprise. I mean, every day there's something new comes out. And then the approach is regulation, patch management, configuration management, but it's always reacting to the threat. And I think that governments need to start getting into the business of being more proactive against the threat. And that's identifying threat sources and stopping the traffic in the cloud. And when I talk about the cloud, I'm talking way up at the core. With the Tier 1 Internet service providers do have the ability to see almost all of this traffic, and it does transit a Tier 1 provider almost assuredly all this traffic. Partnership with the government. I struggle with this because We have locations in probably 128 countries, just as many regulations and jurisdictional boundaries, and our networks will travel 70 to 100 international jurisdictions in a second. So the traffic that we have is really the network lays over the political world as an artificial construct. When we deal with regulation and we deal with governments, it's a big pain in the ass, to pardon my French. We have teams of lawyers that have to deal with requests from one country to the next, the European Union.
Well, that's not a bad thing.
No. The problem is I have to get involved sometimes, too. So we have to deal with privacy issues in Europe. We have to, you know, pornography is illegal in India, so is the site being hosted there or here or whatever. And I think that partnership with the government, the way it would be helpful for me in my role would to be able to share data back to the government, because again we have a lot of intel that we can pick up off of our networks that we would be happy to share with anybody who asks for it through the right channels. But in exchange, we would also like to get tangible threat information on where we can take our limited resources and apply more effectively to get in front of some of these threats. Now, Tata Communications is an Indian-owned company. It operates globally. We have four or five different American entities. And I've approached the FBI and everybody else and asked if there was a method or conduit where I could get information sharing at a level that was actionable. And the answer has been, absolutely not. Because typically that threat information is classified. It deals with sources. And so, they have meetings and stuff. We go and we all smile at each other. But I don't take anything away from those meetings that are useful for me to protect our infrastructure. One noticeable lack of discussion that I've heard on critical infrastructure is cable landing stations that take the subsea cable systems and terminate them to a terrestrial point. The entire world runs through cable landing stations, and typically they are not as secure as they probably need to be. And if I was a very bad person, I don't think it would be too hard to take a big piece of the network offline for weeks and weeks at a time by looking at a cable landing station. And I've noticed that nobody ever talks about it. Perhaps nobody's thought about it. The comments on India, I lived in India for 2 years just a year ago. I run most of our infrastructure is out of India. We're the AT&T of India, but at the same time the largest owner of cables in the world. But I deal with problems in emerging economies, and it's hard. It has mostly to do with money, because good intentions won't buy you the firewall. And then again, another note on the role of government is our core has no jurisdiction. And any solution that's comprehensive and proactive is going to have to be done in a multi-jurisdictional mode across the world. And the more I think about it, the more it gives me a headache. And the less I'm sure it can be done. Perhaps the pain isn't enough, right? Maybe the chemical plant hasn't exploded, or the electric grid hasn't gone offline, or it's certainly or the banks haven't been robbed enough to get some of that done. And then, of course, the comments on the SCADA devices is always just every time I read that, it's just outrageous that you can go over the public internet and touch a SCADA device. I know there's technology to just stop that, and I don't know why. And that's my comments.
Well, you talked about the headache and the pains elsewhere, and I was tempted to ask you which was worse, but I won't. But I will say, actually, before I left DHS, we did launch an inquiry into the kinds of equipment that companies that ran cable landing zones were actually landing facilities were actually installing, and the security of that equipment. And then I left. So I can just say to the new guys, I say, so have you solved that problem? It is clearly a major concern, and there has been some attention, whether it's enough to actually address the security
security problems you see is a different question. So, Phyllis, would you like to sum up for us, and then we'll open up to questions?
Oh, there's that. Technology's always amazed me. cyber's really evolved from what the nerds did about 20 years ago to something that hosts our drinking water. And as you look at that evolution, I remember in 1998 down in Atlanta being at the Sam Nunn, at that time it was Nations Bank, Information Security Forum. And that was one of the first exposures that we had in the U.S. to combining this notion of nerd science with people, science and technology, to come together. And I think of all the points that we've heard, when you look at going around the world and sizing up the critical infrastructure issues, and I don't think issues is a broad enough term to say that, but taking that electronic technology that scientists put together and built this internet that now, to quote a colleague of mine, is being used as a massive malware delivery system that targets the very systems whose electronic controls keep our grid up. Now is the time to look internationally and work in these partnerships and understand that the technology is here to not only support the infrastructure, but the technology is here to protect it. If you look at the evolution of two things that are very important, one is computer processing time has evolved. So companies like McAfee, like our colleagues in the industry, we collect intelligence, much as do the carriers, in a different way. It's complementary, about what's happening all over the cyber weather map. And at any point, putting all of us together can give you the global radar map and the ability to use that computer processing speed and do exactly what Adam is talking about and what colleagues in the audience, what John and others have looked at AT&T and other carriers, and the ability to take the harm out of the internet from the core all the way to the layer 3 VPN at the edge of the customer and take a lot of it out to begin with can help us remove a lot of the threat. And we've come to a technology point where that's possible, but a policy point where we have to explore that. To the points in the report and the different cultures all over the world and the disparate positions that some of the countries are in and how they look at the problem. One example is being in Tokyo and briefing the Japanese government about this just 5-6 years ago. They are very, very interested in what we do for partnership, in that the private citizens feel obligated to do whatever the government tells them to do. Whereas in our culture, we're a little more even and we can work on what is the role of government. But overall, we have to work with all of those different cultures. And we have to figure that out because the bad guys right now are better than we are. And they're winning this war, and that's because they don't need a meeting to do bad things. They share information. They don't have competitive problems. They don't have IP issues. And they don't care about protecting their stuff because they're doing a much better job of outbound getting us, and we're the ones behind. So as far as these partnerships, we need to escalate the work that Sue and Jenny and their colleagues have done for us and make sure that we strengthen those partnerships and maintain our leadership in leading the globe on this. To the point about some of the different groups that are set up, that cross-sector cybersecurity working group is an extremely important group, and it looks at how you bring all the different sectors in to understand that cybersecurity is the nexus. There's another group that came out of the Critical Infrastructure Protection Congress, which is sponsored by the ISAC Council, the InfraGuard National Members Alliance, and the PCIS, or the Partnership for Critical Infrastructure Security, that's working with DHS. It now has a sanctioned group within the PCIS to focus on where the private sector is going to go in helping craft an extension to the National Infrastructure Protection Plan globally, worldwide. And my partner in crime in that is the former Assistant Secretary for Infrastructure Protection, Colonel Bob Steffen, who really helped create what we now live and breathe every day in this unique partnership is called the NIP, and really extend that internationally. So we're working to lead that as well. I think education and awareness are huge components. When you look at some of the countries and what they're reporting, you know, is your SCADA system connected? If everybody didn't say yes, they're wrong, because in every one of these cases that I've ever seen, there's some guy that connected a cable modem out the back door so he could go home and watch the football game and still do his monitoring. So understanding what connected really means is part of understanding the vulnerability and being able to monitor for that. And again, the key is resilience. You can't prevent things like that. We're people, but understanding how to look at it, find it, and come back from it. And finally, just the motivation, right? When we asked Senator Nunn, I remember asking him, I was the student on the committee that put this forward, and I asked the senator, so what is your view? What's the takeaway from this entire forum that we're doing here in 1998? And he said, we have a problem, but there's a solution. And I think those words still ride very well today, especially as a security vendor. There's a lot of technology that can solve a lot of these problems right now. The question is, how do we implement it? How do we economically motivate, incentivize, not just our companies, but people all over the world? How do we use government as a tool? There are a lot of things the government can do that we cannot, as far as information, getting it out, taking it in, correlating that. And how do we use the best of science and computing power to do exactly what Adam is saying and help the people that provide our bandwidth provide it better? And I think that report leads to and opens this dialogue worldwide for the first time.
Thanks, Phyllis. I was struck by your saying it's a little more even in the industry-government relationship, and I have to compliment Sue and Jenny. If in the last year you've gotten us up to even, great work, because that's not where I thought we'd left it. All right, so we're now going to take questions. I'll alternate between the room and Tom Gann pulling questions from the web. Any questions? Yes.
Hi, I'm Mark Signorino from the National Association of Manufacturers. The respondents for the survey, which sectors do you see responding more? Did you get more telecom? Did you get more manufacturing? Did you get, where were the respondents, and not just sector-wise, but geographically? Did you get more in the U.S., more internationally?
Yeah. We tried very hard to spread this out so that we would have a critical mass from the sectors and the countries that we targeted. So we knew we would have a better response and a deeper pool in the United States. So of the 600 people, 100 of them are from the United States, 50 of them are from the next six eight countries, and then the smallest number of countries, I think we had about 30 respondents. For sectors, we didn't do it quite as evenly. The only sector for which we had a relatively low number, I think the lowest number was we had 23 respondents from water and sewage, and the remainder were in the 60 to 80 range. So we spread it out pretty well. Obviously, if you tried to break it down by sector in a country, it would be too few to draw any real conclusions from. But when you look across the board, what's striking is that the sectors are relatively close together and the countries are relatively spread apart. And that suggests that, on the whole, it's national atmosphere rather than sector atmosphere that drives people's security consciousness. Tom, do you have a question?
No question.
Okay. Yes, Brent.
Brent Green, Northrop Grumman. First, quick comment on cable landing sites. When I was still in government, we did a major study for the White House specifically looking at that issue. That has been a continuing topic of great significance that's continued to move ahead within government, but not in the open for obvious reasons because of the sensitivity which you cited. And so you can rest assured that the United States is at least focusing on that. Quick question on security. China was highlighted for all of the positive security. How much of that is driven because of their very strong control and censorship?
We didn't ask that question. It would be speculative. There obviously is a tradition of industry cooperating with government or being required to cooperate with government, but I'm not sure that necessarily distinguishes China from a number of other countries that surveyed. So it may be a difference of the emphasis that the government's placing on it rather than the tools that they have. I should correct the answer I gave. There were a couple of sectors where we had 145 participants, finance and government. We had deeper pools than the others, but the remainder were 60 to 80, except for water and sewage. Yes.
I'm Bill Matthews from Defense News. The idea that the two countries that are the most feared are the United States or China and the United States, is that based on actual attacks that have originated from those countries? And if so, is it based on attacks that are launched by the government or by independent operators?
I think it's fair to call these are very well-informed observers, but it is their perception. We did not say, did you track your attacks back to a particular location? And I don't think that that would have been easy for these folks to do. So it seems to me that it probably reflects a mix of their experience and their perceptions about those countries from everything from the popular press to history. So I would not treat it as a confirmation objectively that those are the countries that are engaged in the greatest number of attacks, but it's certainly the countries that have the greatest mind share with respect to attacks. Yes.
Hi, Larry Clinton from the Internet Security Alliance. I have two questions, one kind of on the data and one sort of for the panel on analysis. And first of all, thank you for the report. It's fascinating. First, with regard to the data, I'm curious as to whether or not either you can give me the data now or if it's broken down in the report, whether or not you can have U.S. figures on some of these items. I'm particularly interested in the data you reported, Stuart, on preparedness, where you had greater than 40% who said that they are not at all or only slightly prepared. I'm wondering what those numbers are with regard to the United States. And I'm also particularly interested in the statistics you gave on cuts in security, where I thought it was the very last bullet you had, Stuart, where it said that in parentheses, there was 66% cuts in security overall, which is even higher than I've seen some numbers at 40 to 50% cuts in security. So again, I'm interested as to how much of that is U.S. Those are on the data. For the panel, I'm curious if anybody has any opinions on the notion that if the threat, as the report and others overwhelmingly indicate, is so massive and so growing, why are we having any cuts in spending on security, let alone 73%, 66%? I mean, the recession couldn't be that bad. So does anybody have any good speculation as to why we're not having massively increased spending on cybersecurity, let alone two-thirds cuts?
Let me address the U.S. Question first. There is U.S. data on some of these things, and I'd be glad to talk more about it. But just on the question of what's been the effect of the recession on the resources that you have, the average, I think, was that there had been two-thirds had suffered some kind of reduction. About 24% had a reduction of 15% or more, which would be pretty substantial. Those numbers are not so different in the United States from the average. It's almost exactly the same. 66% have suffered some reduction, and a slightly larger percentage in the United States had suffered a significant, more than 15% reduction. It's about 27%. Those are not differences that, to my mind, are very real. That is to say, it's roughly in parallel with the overall statistics that we had. Let me see if there are if there's anybody who wants to take on the question of, why we aren't spending more money. Adam would be good, because Adam would be the person who both has to spend it and who might actually be the recipient of some of it.
Typically, security and technical security in a company is tied up in the IT team. And I don't really care what business you're in. The IT team is a cost center. They don't make money for the company. And when they break out the knives to start cutting down on budgets, IT typically gets hit and hit hard. And I'm not surprised by those numbers. It's difficult for a lot of IT directors and certainly chief security officers to be able to convince the leadership in a company that a risk to security ties very cleanly to risk to revenue. So spending a dollar today can save a lot of money in the future. It's certainly the approach I take when I fight for my budget is I don't talk about security as something nice and warm and fuzzy and something we should do. I make a very big effort to try to describe it as a means to mitigate risk to our revenue-creating infrastructure. But it's a hard sell sometimes when they've got a cut.
Here in the front.
Dan Strachan, National Petrochemical and Refiners Association, Oil and Gas. It's been a busy week for us. just a couple of things. We started a cybersecurity committee about 4 years ago. And our first meeting, you could have shot a cannon and not hit anybody. It's slowly getting more notice. And fortunately, it's things like this article that came out in Christian Science Monitor, which is now in the Wall Street Journal today, and the 60 Minutes thing that was on a couple of months ago. But going back to the cuts and everything, the thing we run into with dealing with education is not educating so much the person to not put their password on a post-it note. It's trying to educate the C-level executives that cybersecurity is something that they need to take seriously. The problem we run into is cybersecurity is not tangible. You can't see it. You can't touch it. Yeah, and it's something that they think of as script kiddies, you know, who are just hacking in. Slowly that is changing, though. I just wanted to also point out to Jenny and her crew, I've been very impressed at the way DHS and others are coordinating information now. And so we're not getting information from one person from DHS and then the same thing from somebody else, and I think that's been really good, at least from the oil and gas sector. And what Adam brought up, saying we need tangible, timely information that is actionable, that is very true. A lot of times the government, even in secure briefings, will say something, and that's old news in our area. And I'm just speaking in oil and gas, but it might be the same in the others. So definitely, you know, we need the breaking news. Thank you.
Yeah, I would have thought nothing would get the industry's attention like being outbid by a dollar only on the blocks that you actually think are really promising based on your internal resources. That will get people's attention. Yes.
Dick Winkler, Sun Microsystems. For the last 5 years, I've been the chief of security for our Sun Cloud, for the operations center, and I've seen these attacks. And I think that to the point of cutting staff out of security, I think that's an excellent point, but I think it misses the underlying problem as much as the point about the bandwidth and the traffic coming in. So to elaborate, I think that complaining about malicious traffic coming through is about equivalent to complaining about how cold it is when you run naked through the street, right, in midwinter. It's kind of a pointless complaint. So the question I have is, was there any data collected as to architecture and how infrastructure was implemented, how networks were segregated, how...
Yes.
Isolation and so
forth. We did ask people on a host of security measures, do you do this? Do you have firewalls between your own entities inside the company, between you and the public internet? We've listed the particular technologies that we asked about and their relative adoption rates. Some of that is not in the report, but at some point, I think if we get questions, we'll dig into the report and release some of that information as well. There was no security measure that was universally adopted. There were a few that were relatively low. I think application whitelisting got the least take up of all the technologies we asked about.
So, as a follow-up, the question to the cost. Were there any questions in the data collection as to maturity and process and operations and so forth, which would go to reducing, you know, the ongoing security costs so I could reduce staff and have a better better security posture?
I don't think that we have something that would really help you say, okay, what should I do to reduce cost and increase efficiency? This is not quite a business survey aimed at that. But I'll take another look and see if there's we'll talk afterwards and see if there's something that we can do that would be helpful in that regard. Yes.
McGuire with Microsoft. Thanks very much for the panel today. I look forward to reading the report. I did have a question for you, though, specifically to your one finding about China leading in adopting security measures. Given that estimates have put piracy rates of software in China at more than 80%, how do you reconcile that issue with your finding that China leads the way in security?
Well, I'm familiar with the view that piracy is correlated to insecurity, and there's obvious reasons why that would be. If you can't get the updates, you're going to be at risk. And it is conceivable that what's going on is that people are adopting the measures corporately but not personally. And so what you have is a lot of pirated software that people are using in their home, but that they are taking security seriously in the workplace. The other possibility is they're piling all of those security measures on top of pirated software, which would undermine your total effectiveness of your security measures, and that may explain to some degree why we see higher security measure adoption, but not an equivalent jump in actual security. So I can't explain it. We did not ask them to admit to any piracy activity. So no use subpoenaing our actual results. Yes.
So one of the things that we did for fun is look at when we got this report back, I think last week, and look at what some of the people came back and told us, matched it up with some of what our data showed us, you know, internally at McAfee. And one of the things you'll notice is, especially between India and China, the countries with a higher amount of regulation, that doesn't necessarily map to a less amount of outbound malicious traffic. What decreases your outbound malicious traffic in the numbers seems to be the higher rate of enforcement or compliance. And that it was interesting that our numbers completely matched up to what, you know, at a broad level, what CSIS found by working with 600-some people. And I think that it's fair, and tell me if I'm off, it's fair to separate some of the piracy issues from hardcore security issues, meaning you don't have zombies, which wouldn't show up in the outbound traffic, and they may think they're compliant in security because they're using some kind of software to prevent bad stuff, but they're not worried about piracy. And I don't know whether they clumped the two in the same. I don't know how they took that. I don't know. It's one way of looking at it.
Yes. Here.
Okay, John Nangas with AT&T. First, let me say this is an impressive body of work. But one of the things I got out of your presentation, I haven't read the report yet, obviously, is the we've got a lot of perceptions of security. Okay, and people talked about, well, I've implemented a firewall. They didn't say whether they had it configured properly or not, but how they configured it. But did the issue of lack of real ability to measure security in a meaningful way come up in this discussion? I think that gets a lot to the issue about the budget cuts. You know, you can say, well, yeah, we need a firewall and we need an intrusion protection device and we need to train our users, but you can't measure it. You can't go to the CEO and say, here's where we are and here's where we need to be and here's the amount of dollars it's going to take to investment to get us to there. You know, you got this. Well, I think we're pretty good, but we could be better, you know, kind of perception.
Yeah, and all the people who said I'm somewhat prepared, which means, I don't know,
mean?
I've spent my budget. I think that's pervasive. We didn't find a way to get at that. Maybe there's a way to get at it. It is pervasive. We at least tried to get beyond people telling you, yeah, I've done everything I need to do, to ask them what they had actually done. But that's not a guarantee, as you said, that they did it right. Yes. No, I think it is a problem we're going to have to address. Now, Seeing big chunks of your intellectual property leave encrypted is a clue that maybe you need to do something more. And we certainly see that. But because there's a sentient adversary here who doesn't want to be measured, finding measures of security that are really that tell you something is going to be as much of a moving target as anything else in this area. So I think we're going to be struggling with that for a while. But it's pretty clear that if you watch this for a while and you're in the position that many of these folks are of having responsibility for security, it's getting worse. We just can't tell you whether it's 20% worse or 400% worse. I should say, for those of you who don't have the report or who are online, it is online now at McAfee.com, so you can look for the CSIS report there to download it. Additional questions? Yes.
Hi, I'm Brett Bruin from Smart Grid Today. I was wondering what needs to happen in the next few years to make the emerging smart grid secure. And if you could please address specifically what role, new roles, FERC might have.
You want to take that, or Asha, you're up.
These are not, as Stuart said, I think we were in agreement in our committee that that looking sector by sector is and sort of reacting to the last known vulnerability is not going to be an effective way to approach cybersecurity. So what I can tell you is there are different proposals for empowering FERC to more closely regulate the electric grid on cyber vulnerabilities. On the smart grid, I think there is a conversation on the Hill that it needs to incorporate cybersecurity from the beginning, that that there are sort of unknown issues that could crop up if we don't approach this on the front side that we'll end up paying for later. But I think it's very much a fluid discussion, and there's also there's a certain amount of convincing that needs to happen that there are people who would rather not. Again, it's the same issue of cost center. There are people who would rather not take the money allocated to smart grid and start putting it into the security aspects of that. So it's a matter of convincing people of spending this money up front rather than reacting to it after.
And I will say, while some of those issues are worked through by our friends on the Hill, that we as government are working together to look at enabling technologies, including smart grid, that while they present great opportunities, they also obviously can result in new risks. And so DHS is working very closely with NIST, DOE, and our other federal partners to ensure that as the smart grid is built, that it is built with security as well. So we are working that in the interim.
I'll offer a personal view, I don't get it. I don't see what the benefits of the smart grid are that are worth the security problems that we're buying, given that we haven't figured out how to solve them. But I haven't studied it, but I think that's a case that has yet to be made. Yes.
Hi, I'm Rob Sheldon from the U.S.-China Commission. I was wondering, you said that there's a
great report, by the way.
Thank you very much. I also thank Northrop Grumman for that. I was wondering if you could speak toward, you said that Chinese companies, there's a perception that the Chinese government is well-equipped to handle challenges. Were state-owned companies a part of your surveying, and if so, to what extent?
Yes, they were, but what I can't give you is the extent to which they were. We looked at large companies, and many of the large companies have a state connection of one sort or another.
Hi, my name is Juan Ricafort, and I'm a student at Georgetown University. We've heard a lot about the issue of government involvement, and I have a question for the panel about specifically which parts of the government should be involved. Obviously, we have the DHS working on a lot of these issues. And I'd like to ask the panel what they think about the role of the Defense Department, particularly the NSA, which, as I understand it, has a lot of substantial cybersecurity expertise. What should the role of should the Defense Department have a role in infrastructure protection, and if so, what should that role be?
In the interest of, since we want to end this by 11:30 and we'd like to at least get one more question, I will ask people who want to answer that question very quickly to push their microphone. Jenny, you.
Well, what I will say very quickly is that from a DHS perspective in the cyber critical infrastructure protection role, we want to leverage the expertise and the information and the capabilities that DOD has. So, for example, the Department of Defense has developed a program with the Defense Industrial Base, part of our critical infrastructure, where they've developed a set of products, really that actionable information sharing about the threat and mitigation strategies. And so we've been working with them to leverage those products that they've developed to be able to share with the other critical infrastructure sectors on a pilot basis to see if they're useful to them, and also a structure they've set up where it's a bidirectional process where, in addition to the information getting out, companies provide information back about what they're seeing in their network.
Thank you. Evan Sweetman, C4ISR Journal. I was actually just at a conference the past 2 days with the military, and they were talking about just beginning to look into proactive or even predictive defense against cyber threats. This was coming from DARPA. I was wondering what's being done on DHS side or even the private sector side in regards to predictive threats.
And I'll keep it short and we can chat about it afterwards. But as an industry, and this is what we live and breathe all day, you can actually chart cyber activity at a very granular level all across the world and understand, even if it doesn't have a funny name yet, such as whatever worm, you can understand that it's bad and you can block it. And there are two main ways you see it. One is the way that I think Adam probably sees every 5 minutes, if not more, which is the big DDoS attack. They see it constantly and can stop it. We can also see tiny little events that happen tens of thousands of times at once, but disparate all over the world because the bad guy knows how to elude law enforcement. So all that is happening, and it's built into a lot of the industry, and it's getting stronger.
Well, we don't do anything about it. We just watch it.
We kill it. Just.
All right. Well, thank you very much for attending this and for your questions. And to the panel, please join me in thanking the panel.